Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marches, they never changed anything.
Out to the moon, come out,
many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me.
Friends, it is time once again for our daily message of hope. And with today's message, here is Richard Eaton.
Friends, to brighten your day, here is our message of hope. A man who taught many wonderful truths about life once said, make the most of your present opportunities. Make the most of your present opportunities. Let me repeat once again. Make the most of your present opportunities. And the longer I live, the more convinced I am, this is a wonderful piece of advice. Appreciate the present before it becomes the past. Make the most of your present opportunities. So many of us waste our present time worrying about the past or the future. And actually, we can do nothing about either the past or the future. Little sympathy or patience should be wasted on the person who is eternally crying for the good old days or bemoaning that things aren't as they used to be. Naturally, they aren't. Time changes all things, as it is changing you right now. And were it not for change, there could be no progress in this world of ours. Probably a good bit of advice to all of us would be to live every moment as it comes to us, just as though it were the only one we had on earth. To appreciate the present before it becomes the past. Let your life be filled now with love, with happiness, with harmony, with courage, with faith. Too many of us are wasting energy trying to relive the past. And we are putting off our good from day to day, from month to month, and from year to year, so that we never quite catch up with it. Why not live now? Forget the troubles of the past and stop dreading the future. The expression of our powers and abilities is governed by our thoughts. If our thoughts are dwelling in the past or in the future, our power and abilities will be lessened in the present because they will be trying to follow our thoughts to realms that do not exist. We need all our abilities right now in the present moment. We cannot afford to dissipate them by letting our mind dwell on the past or by worrying about the future. If we live rightly every present moment, we shall have no occasion to mourn over the past. What does it really matter today, what happened yesterday or some other day in the past? It is beyond our recall. So it is not worth the effort of worrying about it. Dr. Frank Crane expressed a bit of good philosophy on this matter in his short article called The Past. Says Dr. Crane, a good deal of morbid nonsense has been said and written and thought about the past. The past is irrevocable. We have been told in sermon and story. You cannot escape the past,
The past can never be changed. And so on and so on. The whole trend of this thought being that the past is a kind of a Sherlock Holmes, dogging our steps forever, a sinister nemesis, waiting its chance to strike us down, the account book of an angry God, sure to confront us someday. All of this is morbid. Most of it is dramatic. The underlying sentiment of it is false, weakening, and septic. As a matter of fact, our past, as Maeterlinck puts it so well, depends on our present and changes with it. Our past depends on our present and changes with it. What the past is depends upon the way you are now using it. Its effect upon your destiny will be gauged by how you translate it into the future. If we brood over the past and weaken ourselves with vain regret, with self-contempt and remorse, then that past will poison and undo us in the present. But no matter what the past contains of our sin or folly, we can, by a right use of it now, make it minister to our welfare. First of all, we can learn wisdom from the past. By it, we can realize our faults to be corrected and our offenses to be atoned for. And with this wisdom, we can go on to better things. The only true repentance is so to use the past as to enable us to build a better future. Weeping and wailing and brooding, those are the luxuries of morbidity. The past is beneath our feet. We can go down into it and wallow in impotent grief, or we can step upon that past to higher things. The great enemy of life is despair. The great friend is hope. Despair paralyzes, ruins. Hope energizes, for we are saved by hope. Face the future. Whatever the past has been, let it nerve you to spend your remaining days in faithfulness and loyalty to your better self. These are the words of Dr. Frank Crane, and I feel he certainly has the right view. Be concerned about your past only to the extent that it can teach you. The mistakes and sorrows of yesterday belong to yesterday. Yesterday provided sufficient time in which to consider its woes. Most of the worries, the griefs, the heartaches that we suffer are nothing more or less than memory of the troubles and hurts that we experienced some time in the past. If we could only remember that sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. Moffat renders this passage as a day's own trouble is quite enough for the day. And when you stop to think of it, isn't this true? We can readily understand from this that the miseries or woes of yesterday can enter today or tomorrow only through our memory. Before the end of yesterday, we should have put out of mind every disturbing thought caused by yesterday's situations. Those were yesterday's problems, so let them along with yesterday pass from sight and from memory. Let not the sun go down from your wrath is a mighty good bit of advice. Or so it seems to me. We should not let the day close with our mind disturbed. It is too late to do anything about the way we let yesterday close. But we can do something about the way we let today close. Let us set today free in order that we may meet tomorrow, another new day, fresh and clean and unused in the right spirit. Our wrath, mental disturbance, and physical miseries of yesterday have no place in our today. They only serve to crowd out the joys and blessings that are in store for us today. Each new day, a new world will begin for us if we do not carry into it the woes of yesterday. If we have not forgotten the woes of yesterday, we do not really experience a new day. To us, the day it's just an extension of yesterday. When we let yesterday's sun go down, finding us wrathful and disturbed in mind, We are not obeying the biblical injunctions to forget our miseries. We are not approaching a new day with a clear mind and a clean heart. The wisely given command to forget is a provision for our happiness. Were we to remember all our mistakes of the past, we should not have time to think of the good we want. Thou shalt forget thy misery. What shall we forget? What does the misery include? What comes under the category of wrath of mind? Everything not founded upon God or good and truth. It was meant that we should enjoy today to the exclusion of the wraths and miseries of yesterday. We are not to let one little rankling thought of yesterday sully the purity and beauty of today. You know, friends, the sleep that God gives us at night is but a form of his power to help us forget. Sleep is a vestibule through which we pass from one day to the next. We are to shed all our useless thoughts before we approach the next day. What of the wrongs that someone had committed against us yesterday or some other day? What of our jealousies and suspicions? What of the things we secretly accuse ourselves of? All these must go. We must forget them. They belong to the dream or nightmare of the past in which we have awakened to a new day. Are you willing to obey the command, "Thou shalt forget thy miseries"? You alone can decide. You alone can reap the benefits of forgetting. You alone can decide whether you will spoil this new day, fresh and clean and unused, by harboring the adverse thoughts of yesterday. You alone can decide whether you will today remain in the wrathful state of mind of yesterday, or whether you will make the most of your present opportunities. The things of yesterday brought to your mind, which caused you to be disturbed, are quite insignificant today. Forget them. Learn to wipe from mind every thought that works against your highest good. Enjoy today to the fullest. You can do this only by approaching it with a clear mind, receptive to the good in store for you. Let each new day begin life anew for you, rather than being merely an extension of yesterday. Start out this morning by obeying the command to forget. Make up your mind you are not going to try to carry yesterday along into this brand new day. Erase from your mind any sense of blame, any memory of failure, all thoughts of wrongs of the past. Was it not Ruskin who said, "Let every dawn of morning be to you as the beginning of life, and every setting sun be to you as its close"? Then let every one of these short lives leave its sure record of some kindly thing done for others, some goodly strength or knowledge gained for yourself. Let me repeat, let every dawn of morning be to you as the beginning of life, and every setting sun be to you as its close. Then let every one of these short lives leave its sure record of some kindly thing done for others, some goodly strength or knowledge gained for yourself. It behooves all of us to live in the present in the way that will make of our future that which we wish our present were now. Yes, friends, it's up to us. We can go down into and wallow in impotent grief, or we can step upon the past to higher things. It is up to us. And so, friends, you've been listening once again to our message of hope. God bless you, everyone.
Listen again tomorrow, friends, for another message of hope with Richard Easton. This is UBC, the United Broadcasting Company.
All right, we've had our morning motivation here, and not only that, started the weekend. Today's podcast on It's My House is titled Slavery, an Experience, and victimhood equals an identity. 619-768-2945. I heard a very interesting podcast live stream yesterday morning, Female Solution, and It inspired me because I think the hostess of that show, the executive producer, she hit on it 100%. Slavery was an experience. Or even in 2021, depending on who you are or what part of the world you're in, slavery is still an experience. It is not an identity. Victimhood, on the other hand, is an identity. So we're going to play some clips here. If you got any thoughts on this, my whole thing is slavery is an experience. It's something that I have not personally experienced. I don't know anybody that I've ever met who's experienced slavery. Now, slavery exists in the world. That experience, there are people that are experiencing slavery right now. But once again, slavery is not an identity. It's an experience. In my family, my parents never experienced slavery. My grandparents, who could have been born, they weren't born that early. They didn't experience slavery. Now, my great-grandmother, from her speech and the fruit on her tree, she didn't experience, or if she did, she did not identify as a slave. I didn't hear any victimhood stories nowhere in my family coming up. But you might have a different experience, but I can tell you this. Anybody who's living and breathing, what's this, May 14th, 2021, anybody living and breathing that's listening to this live stream or to record it afterwards, you're not a slave. You might have, because there are people who have experienced slavery, but I very seriously doubt that the average person listening to this podcast has ever experienced any type of slavery. Now, depending on you, who you are, you might identify as a victim, but even when it comes to victimhood, that's a choice. Two people can get beat up by the same person, and one person might identify as a victim, and the other person might identify as, well, lesson learned. Here's what I can do on the next go-around. Anyway, 619-768-2945, slavery, an experience, not an identity. And victimhood is an identity.
For virtually all of the known history of Homo sapiens, humans were known to have enslaved other human members of other groups, and this is a near universal trait seen in virtually every culture throughout all continents without fail. And it's even possible that our stronger, smarter cousins, the Neanderthal, might have been enslaved by early humans, as it has been found that female Neanderthal lineages can be seen in modern humans, although male Neanderthal lineages cannot. Of course, most people already know that the vast, vast majority of slaves sold from sub-Saharan Africa were not exported to the United States of America, with the bulk that crossed the Atlantic landing all over Latin America, so much that in the present day, the majority of the population of many Latino countries, such as the Dominican Republic and Brazil, have at least some African ancestry. And in fact, there are about the same number of self-identified blacks in Latin America as there are in the United States, as I discussed in a video some time ago. But in American curriculum, we are told many stories about the toiling work of slaves and a few daring stories of escape, but not really much else. And it would probably come as a surprise to many that although by and large the overwhelming majority of escaped black slaves in the southern U.S. made their way north where they would gain sanctuary, with some even making it as far as Canada. Out of blacks that had gained their own freedom by barter, favors, or simply getting lucky and being released in a slave owner's will, many remained in the South. Shockingly enough, in 1860, out of nearly 500,000 free blacks in the U.S., 45% lived in southern states, with 15% of free blacks in the region owning slaves themselves. Although the bulk of this community were mulattoes of significant European heritage, many being nearly indistinguishable from other whites, yet because of the one-drop rule that instilled the strict racial dichotomy seen there, were considered colored in the United States Census. This rule is what largely helped these various communities of African or partial African descent to coalesce into a single ethnic population following the Emancipation Proclamation, falling under the umbrella category of black, which described not only the free people of color, Louisiana Creoles, a group which can largely fall under the former category, Gullah of the Carolinian coast, escaped slaves who had escaped north, and, of course, the roughly 3.5 million remaining blacks who had gained their freedom. The divisions between these groups are largely absent in the present day, with a couple exceptions, and most fall under mainstream American culture, but this is definitely not the case for other areas of the Americas, as, of course, Dominicans of mixed Spanish, Taino, and African descent would not consider themselves to be remotely similar to the Haitians lying on the western half of Hispaniola, although in Brazil, racial identification is far more fluid, being much more of a spectrum than any other country on earth, as many self-identified whites are less European than Pardos, and many Pardos are less European than blacks. Brazil, being the last country in the Western Hemisphere to abolish slavery, also has quite an interesting history with their various African-descended populations. It is true that Brazil imported more African slaves than any other country in the Americas, with over 7 million crossing the Atlantic, and as a result, over 30% of the national gene pool is of African origin, as mentioned, with various groups having high variation, with even old-stock colonial-descended whites sitting at around 10%, and many slaves in Brazil had gained their freedom quite early on, such as during the Dutch-Portuguese War, wherein both the Portuguese and the Dutch employed a large number of African slaves, promising their freedom. Henrique Dias was the leader of the Afro-Brazilian Regiment in the Northeast and loyal to the Portuguese during the war and up until his death in the 1600s, having traveled to Portugal in order to personally convince the crown to free the remaining enslaved men that served in the war. But rather than being freed due to displaying their loyalty and willingness to die for the crown, another group of free blacks who managed to escape began to develop in the northeast of Brazil, known as the Quilombola or Macambo, who came from many different tribes and nations throughout Africa, with a substantial percentage being Muslims. The Quilombolas incited several slave rebellions in northeast Brazil in the 17th century, which resulted in a great ire being directed towards them by the Portuguese officials, and the chief Quilombola settlement was raided, and the entirety of the community was believed to be killed or enslaved by the Portuguese and later the Brazilians. Fascinatingly, it was not until nearly three centuries later in the 1970s that it was discovered that the Quilombolas were not entirely eradicated as once thought, as a small group had escaped to the sparsely populated interior of Alagoas in other states in the northeast, some having integrated with Amerindian villages, and others having established their own communities hidden in the jungles for generations, having a far more African-derived culture than other African-descended people of Brazil, and are treated much in the same regard as indigenous Brazilians in the present day. Another similar community in Latin America, where descendants of escaped slaves are for the most part known collectively as Maroons, were the Palenquero of northern Colombia, who similarly are the descendants of blacks who escaped slavery from cities on the Caribbean coast and fled further inland, creating the village of San Basilio de Palenque, and the Palenquero today speak a unique Creole form of Spanish, arguably the only form of Creole Spanish in the Americas, being heavily influenced by Amerindian and African languages, and outside of this, there were many, many cases of escaped black slaves integrating into Amerindian villages, just as there were in the United States to a lesser extent. So there were indeed Maroon communities and English-speaking British colonies. It was just with the United States having such a large white population and density compared to the West Indies, it was far more difficult for escaped slaves to actually form their own communities in secret, which was why the overwhelming majority, especially in the twilight years of the antebellum South, chose to trek north rather than stay put. The British West Indian colonies initially had white majorities, with the Irish being used en masse as indentured servants in Barbados and elsewhere, and in fact the majority of Afro-Caribbean populations from Anglo countries have at least some Irish ancestry in their heritage, but as the slave population increased higher and higher on the West Indian islands, more and more of the non-slave-owning whites of these islands decided to leave in kind, mostly to the United States, largely homogenizing them. This also came with the consequence of large-scale uproar and dissatisfaction among the plantation working slave population, outnumbering their masters 200-1 in some areas, and hence a large number of slave rebellions were set off across the Caribbean. Unfortunately for most, there really was nowhere to run on some of the smaller islands, but on Jamaica, Maroon communities had existed since before the British even took control of the island, a relic of slaves who had escaped to the mountainous interior from the Spaniards. And during the British conquest of the island, many more slaves fled to the mountains. So, as you can tell, although European colonial powers were never overly fond of these independent Maroon communities, thinking they might incite further slave rebellions or escapes, most were perfectly content with taking advantage of them in defeating common enemies, proving to be a thorn in the side for the Spanish Empire especially, seen with the English officer and explorer Sir Francis Drake, famous for circumnavigating the globe and discovering the Drake Passage. Drake was a bane to the Spanish Empire, pirating Spanish ships and plundering settlements in the Caribbean for years, making him a national hero in his home country of England. And Drake even personally visited and treated with several Maroon leaders in Central America in order to unilaterally combat the Spanish before dying of dysentery in Panama in 1596. In Jamaica, a large proportion of the interior was populated by Maroons, threatening the ever-growing population of black slaves and plantations all throughout the island, and a large group of Maroons and recently escaped slaves rebelled against the colonial authority, eventually being defeated, with a large number deported from Jamaica, either to the British colony of Sierra Leone, or all the way to Canada, where they helped form the black Nova Scotian community. And although they never made up a particularly high percentage of the province's population in its history, peaking around 3%, it is the oldest African-descended population in the northeast of the North American continent. And they were, up until the 1960s, virtually the only major black population in Canada. The Windward Maroons, who remained neutral during the war, still do exist, however, living quite simple lifestyles with a culture very reminiscent of the African nations they derive from. However, by and large, the most noteworthy Maroon community today are the Guyanese Maroons in the territory of the Guyanas, namely the former British and Dutch territories of Guyana and Suriname, and the current French territory of Guyana. Early in the history of the Guyanas, the Dutch owned virtually all of this territory, although nearly all settlements were on the coast, with large plantations owned by Dutch and a few Portuguese planters, and when African slaves escaped, they trekked for miles deep into the Amazon rainforest, and although some attempted to return to Africa, for the most part, they accepted their fates and created secret villages loosely connected to one another, splintering into roughly six tribes over the centuries, with the Saramaccan and Induka being the largest. Now, unlike other Maroon groups, the Maroons of the Guyanas were never recaptured, conquered, or forced back into the general society, and the Dutch, realizing it wasn't exactly feasible or cost-efficient to launch a full-scale sweep through tens of thousands of miles of jungles, decided to treat with the Maroons, eventually reincorporating them into what would later become Suriname and French Guyana. These were villages of near full-blooded Africans transplanted to the continents of the Americas, and their culture and societies were very similar to that of Africa, having a comparable climate and landscape in the Caribbean region as West Central Africa, and they even adopted a unique script known as Afaka for transcribing their languages, Creole languages with extremely strong African influence. Numbering in the hundreds of thousands in the Guyanas today, around 20% in Suriname and 10% in French Guyana, Maroons have always considered themselves to be very ethnically and culturally distinct from others in the region, as unlike in the United States, there was no binary racial classification. Although due to recent missionary work, the majority of the community has adopted Christianity and is becoming increasingly integrated into these societies rather than being the de facto autonomous nation that they had always been. There are many other fascinating tales of the Maroons such as this, and I hope you learned something new from today's video. Be sure to let me know your thoughts on the Maroons and other free blacks of the Americas. And for today's poll, tell me which group of Maroons captured your attention the most. And as always, this has been Mason. Thank you so much for watching, and I'll see you next time.
Moortown is situated in the lush highlands of eastern Jamaica, and is home to the descendants of independent communities of former runaway slaves, known as Maroons. The inhabitants of Moortown have preserved several economic, political, and social aspects of their specific heritage, including a unique system of communally held treaty lands, a local political structure, and the use of the abeng, a side-blown talking horn of Jamaican origin, which serves as a means of long-distance communication. The African ancestors of the Moortown Maroons were forcibly removed from their native lands to the New World by Spanish slave traders in the 16th and 17th centuries. The term Maroon, derived from the Spanish word cimarron, wild, refers to those slaves who fled the plantations in the early 1600s and established their own settlements in the Blue and John Crow Mountains of eastern Jamaica. By the early 18th century, the Maroon communities controlled much of the eastern part of the island. In order to paralyze the expanding plantation system then under British control, the Maroons formed well-organized and efficient underground military units. After decades of warfare, the British finally yielded to the community's demands for official recognition of their autonomy by signing a treaty with the Maroons in 1739. Originally from Western and Central Africa, with diverse languages and cultural practices, the Moortown Maroons developed new collective religious ceremonies that incorporated various spiritual traditions. These traditional expressions and practices, which were eventually named Kromantyiple, constitute the very foundation of Maroon identity to this day. During Kromanti ceremonies, dances, songs, and specific drumming styles are performed to invoke ancestral spirits. These ceremonies also feature Kromanti, an African-derived esoteric language, as well as rare medicinal preparations.
Last night I showed you how the left ate up another potential racial situation, ended up being a racial hoax, we think. This one from Georgia State lawmaker Erica Thomas. Now, after their dishonest spin fell apart when Thomas's alleged harasser, Eric Sparks, turned out to be a Cuban Democrat, doesn't like Trump or Republicans, part of the anti-Trump resistance, well, it turns out Thomas changed her story. But yesterday, Thomas changed her story back again. If you're confused, so are we.
I want to make sure that everyone knows that in any way, am I backtracking on my statement? Or am I retracting on anything that I said? When he said and made a reference to, go back where you came from. He said it right after he said, no, I know you people. You're ignorant. After that, he kept berating me and harassing me. And that's when I said, and you can see from when the cameras will be put out from Publix, I pointed to the door. And after he said, go back, I said, you go back.
None of this should come as any surprise given Thomas's history. She once unironically called herself Jussie Smollett's hashtag biggest fan. Just over a year ago, Thomas portrayed another slight, this time reportedly at the hands of hotel employees. At the pool at the Westin, and after the waitress asked the Caucasian people on both sides of me for their order and skipped over me, minutes later, the pool boy asked me for my room key. This cannot be real right now. I am a guest too, right? Hashtag racist. Was this true? Impossible to prove, but that's kind of the point. You see, Thomas is a member of what we call Generation G, or the grievance generation. They are the product of decades of leftist control of our schools, our entertainment industry, and they're breeding a culture of resentment and envy, basically a society of victims. And the victims, no matter what, are always right. Here now to discuss, Candace Owens, founder of the Blexit Movement, and former DNC comms director, Luis Miranda. Great to have you both here tonight. Candace, Thomas isn't completely to blame here. There's a Democrat and media complex that all too often rewards this. It is a kind of a grievance culture. I mean, Generation G, we hear about Generation Y and X, but gosh, there's a lot of grievance out there that's kind of unprovable, the underlying allegations.
Right. You know, in many ways, she is a victim of the culture, and I've said this over and over again ad nauseum, which is just that victimhood has become almost a mental plague upon Black America in particular, because that word racism is being so overused that society is becoming desensitized to it, and we actually can't even recognize it when it actually exists. We think everything is racist. Things that used to be normal conflicts between human beings, getting cut off while you're driving, having a bad correspondence in a grocery store, you should just brush it off, shrug it off, and move on with your day. Now people are crying and making videos and pleading on Facebook to say, look what I experienced today. I mean, it's sad for her, but I think it also says, as you mentioned earlier, it's something bigger that's happening in culture that needs to be addressed before it goes too far.
Luis, the individual who she accused seems like he really doesn't like Trump. He's a Democrat. He's Cuban. He's not a white man. What are your thoughts on how this all went down?
Well, he's easily the worst person in this story, and he's someone who looks at a pregnant woman in front of him and decides to insult her, and by his own admission calls her a lazy SOB. There's probably a tinge of racism there. I can't believe that he would call her a lazy SOB if he didn't have some of that. But the media certainly overplayed this. But none of that absolves the fact that the discourse in our country has coarsened way too much, that there's way too much racial tension. If he did tell her to go back and use another line, it's understandable that she may have misunderstood that based on the incredible tension that we have and the discourse that we have right now about these racist things that Donald Trump uses for political gain. So that's definitely an underlying problem. But at the end of the day, I think that the bad person in this story is really this man who, instead of seeing a pregnant woman and asking
rude.
Help.
Yeah, he's a jerk. How many times do all of us in the course of maybe a week have something happen where someone's slighting us or someone's saying something, they're cutting off, as happened to me today,
cutting me off with
a millimeter. I got three kids in the car. Millimeter away from me, and then flipping me the bird. Wait, why are you flipping me the bird?
But can I ask a question? Can you insult a black person? Can you insult a black person without being a racist? That's just a question.
I think the minute that he went with lazy, he was using.
Why are you saying
black people are lazy?
No, but that's
why does the word lazy make you think about?
That is a common racist.
No, it is not. I've never been called lazy in my entire life. So the question is, why does the word lazy make? No. I'm asking a question. I asked you a question. You said that lazy makes you think of black people. That's what you're saying.
That is a common racist trope.
So that's within you, not within him. That is not a common racist trope towards black people.
And it's incredible that you're defending a man who looks at a pregnant woman.
I think he's a jerk. I think he's an absolute jerk.
That is so disgusting.
You're trying to be insulting because you're trying to move the ball because you just accidentally called black people lazy. That's what really happened.
I know what you're...
It's a typical racist trope.
Okay? It's not a racist trope. Lazy is a word that means that you're not doing all the time.
Okay, we got to stop, guys. It's getting too hot. Okay, but I think this does go to the point that we should be able to have bad days, and people should be able to make mistakes. And he probably made a mistake and was really rude to her, and he admitted it. That doesn't mean he's – maybe he is, maybe – no one can know, but the point is the second an allegation goes on a Facebook Live, whoever makes it, I don't care if it's a conservative or a liberal or someone in between, it's instantly picked up if it's validating – a progressive worldview that's instantly picked up. Got Eric Liu goes on TV, congressman. We had people on television, pundits weighing in. You see, this is what Trump's caused. And I think he seemed to be saying, go to the next, go back to the other aisle. So now go back to the other aisle is go back to your country,
the media,
which she changed her story
on. More careful with anything that goes viral. And look,
Ted Lowe,
a lot of the discussions that we have on this very show are a grievance culture in and of itself, just from the other perspective. So the reality is that we have a culture that is incredibly divided, that the debate has coarsened, and you either have a grievance on this side or you have it on that side. And at the end of the day, what you have to do is, you know, I think of Dr. Martin Luther King's call to, you can't drive out darkness with darkness, you have to drive it out with light. And that's where we have to move the country forward, is that we're not attacking each other in this way, where somehow these kinds of confrontations become normal. The police confrontation that you saw earlier, unacceptable.
Think, again, the lack of respect that we talked about on the angle tonight, this is not something that happened overnight. We saw what happened during the Obama years, before Obama, during Bush, during Reagan, before that, going all the way back to the late 1960s. You go back and you watch that raw footage of that police versus the protesters. They were bad actors on both sides of that, the DNC. That was not very long ago. That's when it all kind of began. And the disrespect cuts across many levels of our society. And it kind of ends up where people feel afraid. A lot of people I know are afraid to say anything. They don't want to share a thought because someone will take it the wrong way. They're afraid to say their opinion on anything. That's also not a good place to be. Candace, I know you've been through it. Well, also, we have breaking news. Candace just gave us this news. Sorry, I forgot. You were blocked tonight. Speaking of, maybe AOC thought you disrespected her. You disrespected AOC?
Yes, I got blocked.
How do you dare do that?
It's
you can't
really
do
sad.
That.
Yes, I mean, I called her an intellectual coward because she says a lot of things and she throws a lot of insults, and yet she will not debate anybody. She doesn't want to debate people on the opposite side of the aisle. And I think that if you actually believe what you believe, you would be happy to sit down and have a discussion and a dialogue with somebody to get to the core of whose ideas are better. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe that she believes anything that she says beyond getting clicks and getting retweets.
I believe so. She believes. I disagree. I think she believes it.
I don't, because why not just show up and have a debate?
Well, maybe
why not debate someone?
Yeah, well, maybe she's not very comfortable in debate, but I think she actually,
calls everyone racist.
Yeah, that's, unfortunately, that kind of ends the conversation.
It does, instantly, and it's unfortunate. We have to be able to just call somebody lazy.
Yeah.
We have to be able to just say awful things. We have to be able to be in a bad mood.
All right, Lois,
not everything is racist.
I don't agree with AOC a lot, but I might block you, too, after this conversation.
Because
I'm just kidding on that one. But the reality is that the debate has gotten way too coarse, and we need to change it. And I think Democrats, if they're going to beat Donald Trump in November of next year, we can't fall into the same type of rhetoric that we're trying to fight on the Republican side, whether it's about Ivanka or Kellyanne or anybody else.
Okay, guys, we got to go. We're up against the heartbreak. Thank you so much, panel.
Do you all believe as a race, I'm not talking about you specifically, but do you believe as a race, African Americans, we play the victim?
Hey, man.
I have a dream.
No. I'm just going to leave that as a one-word answer. I'm not even going to jump in deeper than that. No.
Yeah, I'm on the side of absolutely not. And I will leave it there until somebody disagrees.
Yeah, then I'll jump back in. And now I'm going to step back.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm going to be real. I'm going to say yes.
Let's go.
I'm gonna be real. I'm gonna say yes.
Give me an example.
See, it's a loaded question. Just because I'm not gonna sit here and say every single African American side either on the yes side or on the no side.
Mm-hmm.
I say yes to mainly spark conversation, but also I know you're not talking. You said not personal experiences, but that's all I got to go on. I will say, you know, just based on where I am in life, I've gotten a lot of pressure from African Americans feeling like, you know, I've gotten to where I am because of white people, or you didn't grow up like I did. Like I came from the hood, you know, I didn't have the same opportunities and privileges that other people had. And though, you know, I believe that to be true, in today's America, I really do feel like anybody has the opportunity to rise to the occasion. Now, is it easier for certain people over others? Yeah. I mean, let's be real. Yes. Like, that's 100% true. But, you know, I just keep hearing, like, systemic oppression, this, that, and the third. Like, yeah, we get it. I know. Like, we all know. Like, we all know. But the opportunities are still there. Will you have to work a little bit harder to get to where you want to be? Absolutely. Because of how you look? Absolutely. I'm a testament of it.
Anybody gonna say nothing?
I want to hear this.
I think it's impossible to accuse us of playing the victim. You're talking about a 400-plus year head start for a particular set of people. You're talking about systematic oppression. That's what I meant by a post-traumatic state. Is we're at this stage in 2020. We're trained to say, yeah, it's unequal, but and that's just not okay to me. I don't think we should ever get to the place where we just accept inequality.
Correct.
I'm not encouraging stagnation, so I agree with you. I'm not encouraging throwing in the towel like, yo, it's not fair. That's not what I'm saying at all. But while striving to be your best self, you should never accept inequality. And I think that's what we're being trained to kind of just be like, yo, this is just the way it is, and to no longer call it out. And I'm not even saying we got to go picket, protest. I'm not saying none of that. But at least in conversations like this, if we're not going to set a standard, no standard is going to be set. Nobody else is going to stand it. Nobody else is going to set it. You're talking about, statistically, like factually speaking, at the onset of the 20th century, you're talking about land owners only giving land to specific races. That's generational wealth. Yeah. You're talking about bank loans only being given to specific races.
How can you?
That's generational wealth.
Correct.
So we can't. It's not even like this is ancient history. That's what blows my mind. This is recent history.
But he didn't say that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. What he said was, "Do we play the victim?" Mm-hmm. And I think that's very different. You're aware of the things that have happened, but are you victimized as a result of it?
So,
do you say, this is what I can do with what I have been allotted or whatever my place in life is? Are we playing the victim is the question.
Well, I think we have to define play the victim. Okay. Yeah, I think we are the victim.
Because anybody can be a victim.
I think we are factually a victim.
So all races can be victims.
What are we calling playing the victim?
What do you see that as then?
What do I see what as?
Playing the victim, like when you hear that, like what does that trigger for
play,
you?
Play the victim means I'm acting like something is being done to me that's not being done
or
to me.
Or always complaining.
That's what I hear.
Always complaining about our history.
That's what I hear when I hear play the victim. Like you're taking the position that something being done to you and nothing's being done to you. That's somebody playing a victim to me.
This is what I
and
hear.
And that's not the case to me.
This
you know
is what
I, mean?
I hear.
Yeah.
Get over slavery. Stop talking about it. We're all equal now. You should be ahead. You should be further than where you're at. Stop talking about the old days. I'm gonna stop right there. Yeah, that's what it triggered in my head.
Mm-hmm. So, to say like you can't, I don't think you can outrule or like just say, hey, we're some black people aren't playing the victim because everyone uses excuses.
Correct.
And people can be using excuse playing the victim by whatever excuse they may bring. But like you said, and like you said, like, we weren't given an opportunity basically to build that generational wealth. And without that opportunity, we don't own anything. So we are having to kind of look for employment like at wherever you work. And even you said there's one person at D1 that's black. And we're 15% of the nation. That's not an accurate representation of America. So therefore, we may not be playing the victim, but we're getting hurt. In corporate America or wherever part of life. That's kind of just statistics.
I'm going to agree with him. I also don't like the term playing the victim because it does sound like you're alluding to something that is not real.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm not dismissing or negating the effects of 400 years of oppression.
Sure.
And, you know, the things that we've seen and been through. I'm not dismissing any of that. But if we cut it all off and we started with a year ago, we are still being victimized by the stuff you have to see on TV. You have African-American boys who at the age of 11 or 12, all they have ever seen were African-American boys being killed on TV.
Mm-hmm.
That's all they've ever seen. They've not known the life without it because they've watched this happen since they've been old enough to understand.
Mm-hmm.
They are victims. You can go into a grocery store. You can go into an amusement park. You can go anywhere and be mistreated, and you will be a victim today. We're not talking about the victimization only of the yesteryears. You can be a victim tomorrow. And I think if we're all honest, we have been in places where you have been the victim.
That's right.
You were either wrongly accused or wrongly criticized, or maybe let's not even make it a negative thing. Looked over for a job unjustly. It's happening. So you there's a rationale to the relevancy of still being victimized.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like I was, to her point, it's not even like this is ancient history. We're talking about 1960s, 1970s. Like, the Civil Rights Act was just passed halfway through the 20th century. Like, it's not even hundreds of years ago. Like, there are people alive still, like, you know what I mean, who went through segregation that are still alive. Like, it's not even,
of course.
You know what I mean? It's not even ancient history. So I can never agree that the responsibility is on us to fix the mistakes of others. I could never agree with that. I just can't.
And it doesn't take away, you know, something that I said on the back end of my last answer. At some point, as a family, as a community, you can gather the people you love and say, let's get us out of
this.
And then you could say, well, we're no longer playing the victim. We took pride and took our own responsibility. And then you can build all that up, and tomorrow you can go somewhere and still be disrespected.
To that point, in my initial answer to you, I said I'm not making an excuse for stagnation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not no excuse to be stagnant.
Yeah.
It's not no excuse to not grind and hustle and get out here and get it. But even if his question is about us as a race and as a culture,
mm-hmm.
and if I get my family together and pull my family up, that's my family.
Exactly.
You feel me?
That's
not balancing the scales.
That's right.
You know
and
what I'm saying?
It's very interesting. Your point is very, very interesting because I could be an extremely successful black man in today's America and still go somewhere tomorrow and be looked down upon because of what I look like.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask you, because I remember like Booker T. Washington, like the 1890s, to kind of offset the Jim Crow laws. He was
not
like,
saying,
hey,
I'm that old, right? I'm not trying to give you some
factual.
You
remember
him, right? Yeah. I didn't go make sure you know I didn't go to school. All right, brother. I'm the historian.
He said basically,
my grade showing that much, though, for real.
I was going to ask you this. So you said basically to offset the Jim Crow laws that were put in place, we had to educate and be entrepreneurs. And you two have both done that.
Yeah.
So I'd like to hear your experience, because this is, what, 130 years later from him saying, hey, we need to mobilize on our own, get education, and be entrepreneurs. And that will create our own system of wealth. But, I mean, you're only, like you say, you're only one person. It's hard to pull up a whole group.
Of course.
So I'd kind of like to hear y'all's experience as being entrepreneurs.
You can talk many
options. I was going to let you go first.
Simone owns her own shop, too, so I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Oh, okay.
I'm taking it in. I'm sorry.
Listening right now.
Well, like I said, I was kind of raised in an entrepreneurial family, right? I was always taught, don't work. I'll just be honest, my father, don't work for the white man. That was it, right? You get education, anything you can take, put it towards your own business. Put your own 2 feet on the ground. Save your money. You know, get a hustle. You know, he's showing me all these things to do. So it was always in my mind that I had to work for myself. The only way I'm going to come up is to work for myself. So I was never trained to, you know, you're going to get a great education, then you're going to go get a great job, and then you're going to be successful, then you're going to raise a family. That was out. Go get your own brand. Raise your family. Give your brand to your family.
Mm.
Let them continue that generational wealth. So that's the way I was taught.
Mm.
And that's the way I got to keep it moving.
Okay, so
give me so rephrase the question that you had specifically.
Basically, what I was saying is Booker T. Washington said to offset any type of segregation or discrimination or from playing a victim, we need to educate and be entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
Has that experience kind of helped you push through, and have you been able to bring others up because of your entrepreneurship?
Okay, so thank you for that question. I definitely believe that entrepreneurship is freedom.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's ultimate freedom. I was writing down a thought just yesterday as I was flying through Chicago that one sign of enslavement is a name change. That when people say that you're something that you're not. So if I was to, like, go and address the same idea with biblical characters. We could look at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
Mm-hmm.
That was not their name.
Yes.
It was their name that they were given in enslavement. And I can just imagine how they were in a room together, and you know, one of them yelled, "Hey, Shadrach, dude, that is not my name. I'm Toby." You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And I feel like we have a responsibility to know who we are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We have a responsibility to do our due diligence to make our name great. That somebody can walk around and call you a liar. Is that who you are?
Yeah.
That's not who you are. Somebody can walk around and call you a thief. Is that who you are? That's the name that the enslavement has given you, right? And so I think that the only way that we can exercise true freedom is in ownership of our stuff, of ourselves, of our actions, of the things that we create, that we can be makers. I think that this is the time for all hustlers to unite, you know, that we all can make whatever we want to be a part of. We no longer have to sit back and say, oh, it's because of what you did to me. Listen, I was molested as a child. So if we want to go back and talk about victimization of the things that people have done to us, we can do that. Or we can rise above it and we can say, well, this is who I am now. This is what I'm going to do. When I started my business, I could not bake, not even out of a box. I didn't have any money. I didn't have any credit. I didn't have any experience in the business. Nobody was going to give me a loan for anything. I was losing the house that the very bakery exists in right now, 11 years later. Because when you put your mind, this is what I was saying earlier, we can be focused on what happened for us instead of what has happened to us. I believe that it is that blood running through my veins that had things taken from her. You know, it is that blood running through my veins that said, no, you can't come in here. It's that blood that is running through my veins that made my great-grandfather one of the first to be able to sing where he sang. And those are the things that I'm using today to get me from where I am to where it is that I want to be. And it's those things that I'm giving to my children and saying, this is what you have. We're not talking about what we're not. We're talking about what we are. Mm. And I think that's the difference.
Mm-hmm. And when we talk about what we are, what are we doing right as a culture that's setting up our children to have wealth? What are we doing right as a culture to where our children's children will know our names? Are we doing things right as a culture to change the narrative of our finances, of our children?
I can only answer that as an individual and then see what we and my wife also try to do and spread, right? You know, we're all about giving back. We're all about showing and proving. You know, I want to be that beacon that this young brother said, you know what? I want to do what he's doing. You know what I'm saying? I want to go out and get my own wealth. I want to start my own business. And if I wasn't there, maybe he didn't see me. Maybe they never came to my restaurant. Maybe it's just me, you know, but when you're there, we're going to teach you. We're going to give you tools. We're going to teach you about customer service. We're going to teach you how to run a restaurant because that's what we have to do. It's my duty. I have to teach. And again, I can only speak about me. I can't save the world. Yeah. But I can save the people that watch me. I can save the people that touch me. I can save the people that work for me. I do my best, right? You know, so, you know, I just look at it as you have to be that beacon, right? You got to be that shining light to change everything around you. You know, be that leading example.
But I don't think that's anything new under the sun, what you're saying.
No, it's not new.
I think that's what this community has been. You know, it has been a community of people who say, I'll teach you how to do this.
What community are you talking about?
The black community. has gone, I have plenty of examples in my life of people who stuck their foot in the door so that I could pass through.
That's not always out the way we do things, though.
I don't think people necessarily understand what happened last week with the Great Make America Great Again hat. What are you trying to do with the message you're sending?
Well, it was really just my subconscious. It was a feeling I had. You know, like, people were taught how to think. We're taught how to feel. We don't know how to think for ourselves. We don't know how to feel for ourselves. People say feel free, but they don't really want us to feel free. And I felt a freedom in, first of all, just doing something that everybody tells you not to do. I just love Trump. That's my boy. Like, you know, it's like so many rappers. You'll look at a video of Snoop Dogg loving Trump, but then he get in the office and now they don't love him. Like, Trump is one of rap's favorite people, right?
But we talk about this, that before he was elected president, people in hip-hop, it was an in thing to put Donald Trump in your rhyme somewhere.
Yeah. And by the way, I am in hip-hop, but I'm not just in hip-hop. I'm a black person in a black community, but I'm not just that. I feel like one thing is people try to minimize me to artists, hip-hop, black community. Yeah, I'm always going to represent that, but also represent the world. When you hear about slavery for 400 years, for 400 years, that sounds like a choice. Like, you was there for 400 years and it's all of y'all? You know, like, it's like we're mentally in prison. I like the word prison because slavery goes too direct to the idea of blacks. It's like slavery, Holocaust Jews, slavery is blacks. So prison is something that unites us as one race. Blacks and whites being one race, that we're one, we're the human race. Do you feel that I'm feeling, do you feel that I'm being free and I'm thinking free?
I actually don't think you're thinking anything. I think what you're doing right now is actually the absence of thought. And the reason why I feel like that is because
Kanye, you're entitled to your opinion. You're entitled to believe whatever you want. But there is fact and real world, real life consequence behind everything that you just said. And while you are making music and being an artist and living the life that you've earned by being a genius, the rest of us in society have to deal with these threats to our lives. We have to deal with the marginalization that has come from the 400 years of slavery that you said for our people was a choice. Frankly, I'm disappointed, I'm appalled, and brother, I am unbelievably hurt by the fact that you have morphed into something, to me, that's not real.
Bro, you got to be responsible, man.
Bro, I'm sorry
you
I hurt you.
You got to be responsible. No.
I'm sorry I hurt
man,
you, bro.
Bro, your voice is too big. You got to...
I was talking to a cat the other night. He said, what everybody's looking for this? What everybody's looking for today? They're looking for escapism.
good to you. Ain't it good to you? Look at him. What you say, Fred?
Man, you know we better take it on the lamb.
You better watch the man.
I don't like the hood. What you say, Fred? I said we better take it on the lamb.
We better watch the man.
But
come over here, brother. Let me tell you something. You think we're talking too loud?
Hush that butt.
I ain't got no dust.
I don't have to take it on the land.
Watch that man.
Huh?
Watch that man.
Watch him. Yeah, all right. You're right. Yeah, yeah. Coming from some funny places. What you say, bro?
What's happening, Brown?
Trying to get down. Well, you know, look at him. We can't have that. Man, I don't dig it. What you say, Jason?
Hey, don't be so mean.
You know I'm clean now. Yeah.
And on the seat.
Excuse me, Cowboy.
How'd it go?
We got one out of two of them motherfuckers, you know.
You mean you motherfuckers come strolling in here all walking tall and shit?
Yo, B.I., man, I'm saying, man, we was blazing on them dudes, man, you know what I'm saying? Just got in the heat, man, we was blazing, though. It was late.
All right, relax, man. I already heard. Go sit down. I'm not tweaking behind none of this. That's one less motherfucker that's breathing than was yesterday, you know what I'm saying? So we all good. But I'm surprised with you, though, man. Shit didn't get by you back when.
Well, my man's fault, man. I unloaded on the younger too soon, man. Gave him enough room to buck and run, man. I fucked that shit up myself, you know.
Hold on. It's on me. I had that kid in my sights. Close enough to take off his Kango and half his dome with it. Couldn't squeeze the trigger. Couldn't do it, man.
Why not?
Wasn't in me, I guess. You know, whatever it is in you that lets you flow like you flow and do that thing, it ain't in me no more.
All right. So you done soldiering, but you ain't done. Could use you for what you got in your head. We're gonna put you on a corner. You could be inside.
Oh, man, I ain't making myself clear. The game ain't in me no more. None of it.
But you ain't done shit else. You know what I'm saying? So what you gonna do?
But it can't be this.
All right, then. We straight.
B, he's a man in his time, you know?
He a man today. He a man.
All right, today's topic, slavery, an experience in victimhood equals an identity. We're going to come back with, we played a series of, because some people are looking at, well, some people identify. I mean, how do you identify? You know? And just because a group of people had an experience that doesn't necessarily mean that those same people personally identified as you judged them to be. But I'll put it in the form of a question. Was slavery an identity, or was it an experience? I say slave was strictly an experience. We'll be back in 2 minutes, and we'll take your call, 619-768-2945.
And now, an exclusive first look at the upcoming documentary, 7 a.m.
Because true economic science is a branch of military science. War and money go hand in hand. Most wars are fights so people can make more money, and war is money. That means what? That the European American is not about to prepare black children to compete with his children for control of the economic sector. It's not going to happen. So if black people want this science, we got to teach it, we got to study it, and we're going to have to make some mistakes in perfecting it because we're still babies in the water of global economic commerce. As African people, we are financially illiterate. So we should not be surprised that we're so economically backward because we were never taught how to be economically forward. Our education in America has not provided or prepared us to be able to compete with Europeans economically. The historically black college was designed to do what? Teach you how to work for white people. Public schools, charter schools, parochial schools, independent schools. What is the purpose of education in America for black children right now? To teach them how to make a living working for white people. But I don't want the kids coming to my school to be going to class thinking that I'm learning this so I can go and get paid by a white person. They're going to be empowered to start their own business. When they leave that school, they're going to go into business. And why do we need our people to be self-sufficient? Because when you're not self-sufficient, you can't speak your mind. One of the biggest reasons why black people have been so cowardly in the post-civil rights movement, not standing up for ourselves, standing up for our children, standing up against police brutality, we're scared to lose our jobs. We have to work. We got kids. I can't talk about the racism on my job. I might lose it. So the reason why we're not speaking our mind is because we don't have economic freedom. As Mr. Garvey said, Marcus Garvey said, that a solid racial program must be built on a solid economic foundation. Show me your economic condition, and I'll show you your political condition. The political economy of the black community rests on the premise that because they do not make their own money, they are enslaved to Europeans. And as a result of that, they will never be able to do what needs to be done to carve out a future for their children because the hand that pays is also the hand that rules them.
All right, the question today is, was slavery, or is slavery, because it still exists today in different parts of the world, well, for the sake of this conversation, the Civil War, the transatlantic slave trade, was that an experience, or were people like Kunta Kinte, did they identify as slaves? But the title we had today is Slavery and Experience. I look at it as an experience, and victimhood is based on your personal self-image or your judgment of others. Now, just because you see them a certain way, you know, I think a lot of people today, you know, the Ados crowd and all that, I think now, because Ados is what? African descendants of slaves. I think what a lot of these Ados people have done is they have misjudged many of their ancestors as slaves. But if you go back in the time machine, a lot of those people probably didn't identify as a slave. Now, let me go to a piece of this. Matter of fact, I'm going to read you something about a town called Mooretown. That's M-O-O-R-E, Mooretown, Jamaica. Two words. There's a couple of things I want to pick out of this. Mordtown is a maroon settlement located in the Blue Mountains in the John Crow Mountains, not Jim Crow, but John Crow Mountains of Portland, Jamaica, accessible to the roads of Port Antonio. Now, to really appreciate Mordtown, Jamaica, we have to look up the word maroon, and for some of you who don't know what a maroon is, M-R-O-O-N-S, let me read that, okay? And once again, slavery was an experience, or is an experience, and victimhood is an identity. Or you judging a group of people as slaves when themselves, they didn't judge themselves as slaves. Anyway, maroons are descendants of Africans in the Americas who formed settlements away from slavery, period, end of sentence. Now let me read it again. Maroons were descendants of Africans in the Americas. Notice it didn't say maroons were descendants of slaves in the Americas. Maroons are descendants of Africans in the Americas who formed settlements away from slavery. Now, why did they do that? Obviously, they did not identify with their culture. They weren't having it. However, in 2021 right now, there's no shortage of folks that go back in the time machine and have judged these people as slaves, when maroons themselves didn't identify that way. Anyway, they often mix with indigenous peoples, eventually evolving into a separate Creole culture, such as the Garifuna and Maskoutis. Let's see. And then we can, you can go online and look up maroons. There's quite a bit of information about the maroons. Let's go back. I'll read a little bit more. In the New World, which is the Western Hemisphere, as they called it back then, in the New World, as early as 1512, enslaved Africans escaped from the Spanish captors, and either, now, mind you, it said enslaved Africans. It didn't say enslaved slaves. Enslaved Africans escaped from the Spanish captors and either joined an indigenous peoples or eked out a living on their own. I still say the typical person that came across on those slave ships were more educated than your Ivy League person today in the basic fundamentals of life skills, but that's a whole nother podcast. As early as 1655, escaped Africans, now mind you, it didn't say escaped slaves. As early as 1655, escaped Africans had formed their own communities in inland Jamaica, and by the 18th century, Nannytown, well, we started talking about Mordtown. Once again, Mordtown. And now Nannytown, these are communities formed by Africans or descendants of Africans in the New World, which is the Western Hemisphere as we know it today. They never identified as being slaves. And we can all do a whole new reparations dialogue on this one. So if these people, known as the Maroons, if they weren't crying out for reparations and they took matters in their own hands and they started their own townships, Where are we going to Congress in 2021? Anyway, Nanny Town, well, let me and other villagers begin to fight for the independent recognition. Now, let me read about Nanny Town. Nanny Town, or Old Nanny Town, is a village in the Blue Mountains of Portland Parish in northeastern Jamaica, used as a stronghold of Jamaican Maroons, also known as escaped slaves. Now, that's what the people that write these articles, that's what they're calling them. Or even the people that capture them, that's what they're calling them. But once again, see, everything's a contract. I had to bring a lawyer in or somebody like Warren Houston break down what a contract is. See, you might want somebody as a slave, but and it's not until they agree to be one. These people escaped. They didn't identify as slaves. They were led in the early 18th century to the Ashanti escaped slave known as Granny Nanny or Queen Nanny. The town held out against repeated British colonial attacks before being destroyed in 1734. Now let's read about, and then they rebuilt something else. All right, Queen Nanny or Granny Nanny or Nanny was the nanny of the Maroons, 1686 to 1755. Was the 18th century leader. And she's on Jamaican currency, by the way. She's the first woman in the Western Hemisphere, first black woman, or woman of color, as we might say today, who has been on a national currency in the entire Western Hemisphere. In any event, she led a community of formerly enslaved Africans called Windward Maroons. Obviously, these people did not identify as slaves. Matter of fact, anybody who disagreed with what Kanye said, go read up on the Maroons. In the early 18th century, under the leadership of Nanny, the Windward Maroons fought a guerrilla war over many years against British authorities. This is like a chess game. On one side of the board, you had the Brits that they had misjudged this group of Africans or descendants of Africans as being slaves. Now, that's how they judged them. But on the opposite side of the chessboard, you had these Africans who did not identify as that. Their self-image, their self-worth, their self-esteem, they did not identify with that, nor would they agree to be that. Therefore, they had these wars over many years. In the colony of Jamaica, which became known as the First Maroon War. Much as what is known about her is from oral history, little textual evidence exists. According to the Maroon legend, Queen Nanny was born in what is today known as Ghana of the Akan people. According to oral tradition, so here's a person who, for whatever reason, and was taken prisoner in Ghana, if we're going by oral history now. Now, just because she was captured, does that mean she was a slave? Once again, that's somebody outside of herself that has made that judgment. But as soon as she got over this way, in the Western Hemisphere, Jamaica, she organized people that were on the same page. Thus, we have the Maroons, and there were different fractions of the Maroons as well. In any event, I got to get some of my Jamaican friends on here to see if get up, you know, first-hand history. Let's see. Man, I'm trying to, all right. Some claim that Queen Nanny lived to be an old woman, dying of natural causes in the 1760s. The exact date of her death remains a mystery. Part of the confusion is that Nanny is a honorific title, and many high-ranking women were called that in the Maroon Town. However, the Maroons are adamant that there was only one Queen Nanny. According to Maroon oral history, Nanny's remains are buried in the bump grave in Moortown. So there were several people that we in 2021 we call, mistakenly in my opinion, call, we have misjudged these people as slaves when these were essentially people that were going through various types of experiences. Now, of course, you can disagree with that, but, and we're going to, I'm working on getting some modern, some people that might be classified as modern day slaves. They were at one time, but how they got out of that experience because they didn't see themselves that way. And we'll have a discussion one day on this, so how can you really have a legitimate claim for reparations when, number one, you never experienced slavery, and number two, any ancestors that you might be connected to, do you have documented proof positive that they identified as a slave? Now, in my family, and I can only speak for mine, I know on my mother's side, my great-grandmother, when she passed away on her 88 acres. 88 acres doesn't sound like a slave to me or a former slave. I'm just saying. And there's scores of people in their families that they've got acres or had them. That's more than enough to start your own town, at least little town or village, at least. More than enough. But anyway, let's see. It's Friday here, but let's go take at least one call. 314, your mic is open.
L.A., I have where you been lately, man? I asked him, Warren, were you okay?
I've been quiet this week.
We thought the COVID had got you.
Oh, no, nothing like that. Nothing like that.
I was reading the papers, like, and that. I even took a peek in the obituaries.
No, last week I did Monday and Tuesday, then, let's see, I did 3 days doing some offline planning, and then this week I've just been basically quiet. Put on some audio, then I'm running around in and out of the house doing household stuff.
You know, I get sick and tired of talking about this slavery stuff myself.
Well, the only reason why I brought it up today was from Naima's program yesterday, which I think you called in on. And I have to agree, it was an experience, wasn't a pleasant experience, but don't judge these people as being slaves, because many of them did not judge themselves to be that way.
Underground Railroad. Right. But here's the thing, they wouldn't have been the experience of slavery wouldn't have been nothing new.
True.
Right?
Yeah, true. Like I've said before, everybody's been pooped on.
Yeah, the experience of that experience wouldn't have been nothing new for those that was that ended up on those shores in that condition. They could have been expelled.
Right.
Africa taught the world slavery, that kind of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just think of it. Let's go up in Europe. Why would you go up into Spain? Or why would you go up to France or Britain? They didn't have slaves up there. They didn't know anything of it. You had slaves down in the Barbary with those pirates and that. So if they learned slavery the way that it has been described, they would have learned that from who? Learned it from the people whose societies has been involved in it the longest period of time. And that would have been down in Africa, where the climate was conducive for agriculture. Britain didn't have any agriculture. If they have a growing season, they may have one growing season even today because of the latitude that they're in.
Right.
And, of course, you go down the equatorial ranges, you have maybe three growing seasons. So if they wanted particular crops, if they wanted food commodities, they would have went down there and bought them once they found out that that portion of the world existed.
Right.
And you would have had to hire people to do it. Well, you would have been buying their stuff. Let me ask you, how did it work when you go down into West Africa and make people grow crops for you? I mean, just think about that. But let's step back a little. If you went and bought from them and
trading
with them, and if you wasn't trading fair, not free, fair, like we try to do here in the United States, we want fair trade, not free trade, then would the people be messing around with you?
No.
Some of those, even today, farmers put their stuff on those rickety roads and bring them down to the ports, down into Tema. That's what they do. They take them to the ports in Tema. Up in the northern area is Takoradi. And if the British or the Portuguese, let's talk about the Portuguese first, they would have came down the coastline into what's now Cape Coast and St. Augustine. Of course, it wasn't called St. Augustine then. It was a Touareg village along that ocean road that runs all the way clean to Nigeria. That's where they would have set up ports, but it probably would have been more so in Cape Coast.
Okay.
Cape Coast was more conducive for it and situated. Well, that's what they would have been doing trading. Matter of fact, Cape Coast had a – that's why they built the castle there. They built the castle because they had agents. Let's say you were the agent and you were selling you was buying for Warren Enterprises. Warren Enterprises would have sent you over to Cape Coast and you would set up a shop where you receive stuff that you was buying. Now, they didn't have no canned goods, right? So you've been receiving things like potatoes, probably oranges, probably right off the vine bananas, which were still green.
Yep.
Right? And you would have stored it there in the Cape Coast castles. You go to Cape Coast Castle today, you can see all these different rooms, storage areas. That would have been yours. Okay. And when your scheduled ship arrives, your scheduled ship would have dropped anchor offshore because it can't come no closer. People would have got in their boats, rowed to shore, and came to you and said, we come here to pick up what you got. They would load it on the boat.
That's a story that most people never tell.
They loaded on the boat, And Africans would row it, help and row it. Sometimes you could hire their boat so you could hurry up and get it done because you had to be ready to leave by the time a morning come with the wind current. And night, wind blow inland. In the daytime, wind blows outwards, away from the shores. And that's the wind you want to pick up so you can be on your way.
Right.
So that's how that would have worked. Now, commodities just was not food stuff. Commodities could have been people because Africans had been doing that too for thousands of years before they even met any Portuguese.
Correct.
And they probably would have had...
Human resources.
Yes, they probably would have had... Would have had a barracoon because you can't keep people locked up in rooms. They got to have air and all that kind of stuff. So you keep them locked up or contained in a barracoon. A barracoon is just like a where you put cattle. What do they call that? A corral. Barracoon is a corral. And the same process would have happened when they came to get people. They would have done the same thing. You would have had to roll them out to put them on the boat. Now, where Kanye West comes into play, it's a choice because some Africans did not have to do that. You don't have enough people on a ship to go inland and capture folks, and you don't have enough people on a ship to go shore and bring folks out. So they would have probably hired Africans with their dugout canoes to help haul people out to the ships.
I agree.
If you over in Nigeria, and no slave force, you had a lot of the slave markets on the interior. You had about 25 along the coast, and you probably had at least 17 or 20 inland. They can be identified today, clean all the way up to what they call as WA, which is about the 10 degrees latitude. And even going all the way up into Burkina Faso, which is about 11 degrees latitude. Going up into St. Fanny in the next adjoining country. Now, people that acquired humans was merchants. And when they went up into these areas, like the San Sami Mango, they acquired humans that was in barracoo that had been stockpiled, and those humans came there from various different reasons. And those various reasons was probably span the gamut.
True.
From criminals, warmongers, or whatever. And the people
and
that
they
had
the opportunity. Human resources.
Yes, you had to pay. If you couldn't pay, you're going to get sold off. If you were warned with somebody, they're going to kill you. You know, how many Germans got killed in the war? We're talking about millions. Russia didn't say, okay, we're going to capture you. What you going to do with them later on? You got to let them go. They can come back and fight you the next day.
True. You're right.
So that's how that stuff works. And Kanye West was
right.
When, especially over in around Nigeria.
Well, the guy who responded to him, the guy that got upset,
I like to talk to him.
Obviously, he identifies as being a victim. That's where his self-image.
Get him on your show.
Image.
Get him on your show and that lady that was on there talking that 400 year stuff too. Get them on your show.
Yeah,
that'd be
I'm
a good
try to contact you. She's out of New Orleans. Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be a good person to have a conversation with because they totally kind of confused in the course of events. Just like that Umar Johnson talking that, putting that same narrative.
Well,
and
he
that
makes
explanation
his bread and butter is victimhood. That's what he.
And
tells.
You know, you talk about Marcus Garvey. And what he wanted to do, he made mention of a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Marcus Garvey was, what, late 1800s?
Yeah.
Marcus Garvey had a whole lot of black business to study to make the assertions that he did. Because you got records of blacks in the businesses that they had in many different areas that go all the way back to the 1600s. It ain't business is nothing new. You know, those Maroons you talk about that escaped down into Jamaica, they were Semaroons when they escaped off the East Coast and went down into Florida, the Seminoles.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lady that does a good job on it. I can't think of her name. Wrote a good book on those escaped slaves that they left the rice plantations in along the East Coast up there in the Carolina. You know who probably started those rice plantations first?
Who's that?
It was Africans that came over with Columbus, the chiefs that brought their slaves with them to settle this land, just like everybody else did. The opportunity.
Yeah, I'm going to get the Gullah Geechee people. I was talking to somebody last week about that. We've had Queen Quit on from the Gullah Geechee.
Yeah, they're from Sierra Leone. They traced their lineage back to Sierra Leone. It was by oddity, too, because somebody had found a audio recording of somebody singing a song. Yeah, I think it was a white woman. I'm not sure. Some sort of anthropologist. And they were searching around, and just about to give up. And they tried one more place, and the person said, yeah, I know what she's saying. And I know where the people that sing that song come from. So they've done a documentary on it. It's called The Language You Cry In. You probably still can get it today. The Language You Cry In.
The Language You Cry In.
And they took a bunch of over to Sierra Leone. Some people raised money for them. And they went there and they met with that village. And lo and behold, the people in the village were making the same type of stuff, like baskets, weaving, that they was doing over here in America, down there in the Gullah Geechee village.
All right, I found, I think I found The Language You Cry In. There's a little bit of some information on it. It's a movie and a TV show. It's quite a few.
Yeah, it was a movie.
Yeah,
it was a movie. And
The Language You Cry In tells an amazing scholarly detective story that searches for and finds the meaningful links between African Americans, and then I gotta open up the link for the rest of it.
Yeah, that was a very good documentary that the lady done. Most of those research is done by whites. Blacks don't do that. You don't see blacks doing those things. Whether it's in Egypt, going in and out of temples and pyramids.
There's one. Are you familiar with Dane Calloway?
No, not directly.
He's got some, in my opinion, some controversial stuff. I don't know if I agree with a lot of the stuff that he puts out there. I haven't.
What is it based on?
I can't agree with it. Huh?
What is it based on?
Well, matter of fact, let me read some of the headlines here that he's got. Hold it, Dane Calloway. Yeah, because he's got a bunch of. I'm looking at him as. Wait a minute, let me Dane Calloway.
You know, back
now,
in the old
days. Anybody listening has got their opinions on Dane Calloway. I'm not really a pro Dane Calloway person. I'm on his YouTube channel. Let me read some of the headlines of some of his videos. Okay, Matt Turner. This is the headline of some of his videos. Matt Turner is a fictional character created by the Virginia Department of Historical Resources. Another video of his says Harriet Tubman, is a fictional character created by an act of Congress and Sarah.
What do you say
about
John Brown?
Huh?
What do you say about John Brown?
Well, hold on. I don't know if he's done a video on him yet. But he's got, let's see. He's got some controversy, and I've listened to his videos. But
how about Frederick Douglass?
Hold on, he does have Frederick Douglass on here. But, no, he's just got a picture of him in his thumbnail.
Well, some of the things he's saying is not true. Harriet Tubman wasn't.
Yeah, I agree.
Harriet Tubman was real. Harriet Tubman was consulted by, I think, John Brown on his raid at Harper's Ferry, and she refused, like Frederick Douglass refused, too.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to talk to, Brown had to talk to somebody named Harriet Tubman. So, no, she's a real person. There's a lot of history on her. She even, she served with the Union troops.
Oh, yeah, a lot of documented history on her. A lot of documented history on her. But
she was a scout and all kind of things. It's a lot of good, and a lot of history is real good, too. It tells you quite a bit.
True. Well, it's Friday again. Okay. So,
you know something, too? I think I text you about academic scores in public schools as it applies to black children. And I call it a national emergency, a security risk. These kids are not being educated because they can't perform well with what this nation needs.
I agree. As a matter of fact, we'll cover that probably early next week. Monday
and
Tuesday,
it has to be
Monday.
Studied real. You have to do, if you want to leave out of here, you have to do there's a good site called Public School Review. It has information.
Public School Review. Okay, hold on. Public School
as late
Review,
as 2021. So check that out. And what you do is type in some schools that you know, like high schools. I've typed in some great high schools. And I use the Hazelwood in St. Louis that I know of. Hazelwood School District, which has three districts. You got Hazelwood East, Central, and West. And Hazelwood East is practically all black.
Mm-mm.
And as you go to Central and the West, you're moving away into further that county, which becomes less black and hardly no black. But it's about 63% at Hazelwood West. And they list the graduation rate, the math proficiency, and the reading proficiency. Now, if you look at Hazelwood East, which is 98% black, the graduation rate is 77%. Now, this is a high school. This is a school district that blacks moved into around the same time of Ferguson, maybe a little later. I'm not sure on that, but I know for sure where it's at. And whites moved out. Hazelwood School District, Hazelwood East is on the west side, on the north side of Highway 270.
Mm-hmm.
And the other schools, especially Hazelwood West, is out there around Barrington Downs. It's served Barrington Downs, which is that rich area where blacks live. Now, if you look at East, their graduate is 77%. The math proficiency is 17%. The reading proficiency is 35%. Now, you go a little bit closer to getting away from St. Louis, it jumps up. The grad rate is 86. Math is 28. Reading is 42. Now, you get out the west where blacks make up 63% of that school district, the grad rate is 91%. Math is 45, reading is 52. And you got some schools on that I've been looking at that I know of, like Normandy. Their math proficiency is 5%. Reading is 10 to 14%. How about the famous East St. Louis Flyer, that football team that came out of this school back during the days of Bob Shannon when they was nationally ranked? their math proficiency is less than 1%, and the reading is about 3%.
Ooh, 3%.
That's terrible. And then once again, I'm saying it ain't the children's fault. It's the people's fault. The parents, the family, stakeholders, and everybody else who does the things that they're here's U City, who they now have in meetings to change the name of streets. That's the same district, city where the one state rep that said she wished Donald Trump was assassinated. Their math proficiency is 10%, a 91% black school district. And their reading proficiency is 30%. Now, it seemed like to she would have been more concerned about that than Donald Trump. Anyway, I'll talk to you.
We're going to cover that Monday or Tuesday next week. Thanks for that lead. I didn't bookmark some stuff already. Thanks for the feedback, Bianchi.